Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the Riverstone Energy Limited Analyst and Investor Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. There'll be a presentation followed by a question and answer session, at which time, if you wish to ask a question, you will need to press star one on your telephone keypad. I must advise you the conference is being recorded today, Friday the 26th of February, 2016. I'd now like to hand the call over to your speaker today, Ken Ryan. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our full year results call for the period 31st of December 2015. I'm Ken Ryan, and I'm joined on the call by Alfredo Marti as well. Thank you all for joining. In the usual format, I'll go through some of the key financial and operational highlights from the year. Then I'll hand over to Alfredo to go through the performance of the portfolio in a little bit more detail. Then at the end of that, we'll take any questions that you may have. First, I'm sure you've seen today's announcement that Sir Robert Wilson has decided to step down as Chairman of the Board of Oriel at the forthcoming AGM. In addition, Jim Hackett has also given notification that he won't stand for re-election to the board, though he will continue, obviously, in his role as partner of Riverstone and a member of our firm's investment committee. I'd like to say that we are hugely grateful to Sir Robert and Jim for their service in establishing Oriel and overseeing the deployment of our investment strategy for the last two and a half years. We're delighted that Sir Robert will be succeeded as Chairman by Rich Haydon, who's been our Senior Independent Director and Chair of the Audit Committee since our IPO, and Patrick Firth, who's an existing Independent Director, will take on Rich's responsibilities as Chair of the Audit Committee going forward. Going back to the full year results, 2015 was certainly a tumultuous year in the energy industry, one where energy took center stage in the broader financial markets, where access to finance became the most critical question for most, if not all, energy companies. This continues to be the case with oil trading at just over $30 a barrel today. I think it's interesting to note that in these volatile markets, our core investment strategy, I believe, is most compelling. We deploy capital gradually over time across multiple geographies. We tend not to use excessive leverage, and we hedge where appropriate. Added to this, the experience of our core team, who have led companies as large as EOG and Anadarko on down, we believe provides significant resilience to our shareholders. We believe the strength of this disciplined strategy is evidenced in our performance in 2015. NAV per share was $15.95 as of the year-end. That's a decrease of $0.36 or 2% when compared to NAV per share 12 months earlier. On a sterling basis, NAV per share actually grew by almost 3.5% using the year-end dollar sterling exchange rate, going from £10.47 to £10.83 per share. Obviously, with the continued weakness of the pound, as of today's exchange rate, our NAV per share is around £11.40. The slight drop in NAV on a dollar basis is largely attributed to a reduction in the fair value of four of our portfolio companies, and that value drop being driven largely by a decline in oil prices. Interestingly, three of those four companies were investments we made, three of the first four investments we made in Oriel prior to November 2014, which you've heard us talk about in the past. During the fourth quarter, as you'll recall, we raised additional capital to increase our stake in CIOC, which ended up being NAV accretive. The CIOC situation is also an example of the type of opportunity this market volatility is creating. You'll recall that CIOC is one of our largest investments, is our largest investment. It's a high-growth exploration and production company with a very large acreage position and over 3,000 potential drilling locations in the emerging Montney and Duvernay shale plays of Western Canada. Since Oriel's original investment in CIOC in 2014, the company has performed very strongly, and we have opportunistically increased our ownership through additional investments into the company and the purchase of privately held shares and warrants. In November, we agreed to acquire additional shares and warrants at a purchase price of $1.675 Canadian. However, in order to complete the purchase, Alberta securities law required that we tender for the outstanding equity under the same terms. We saw this as a very attractive proposition for a number of reasons. Firstly, the agreed purchase price of 67.5 Canadian per share was at almost a 40% discount to our estimated fair value for CIOC at the time. In addition, since CIOC was an existing investment, we had a comprehensive understanding of the company's assets and had a high level of confidence in the management team, having been board members through that period of time. And finally, this area of Alberta's Deep Basin is characterized by very low drilling and production costs, which makes the company especially valuable in the current commodity price environment. In light of these factors, the board of the company concluded that the uniquely attractive nature of the opportunity warranted the issuance of additional equity, and that placing an open offer was the most appropriate mechanism. On December 9th, Auriel successfully completed this transaction and raised its targeted amount of £68 million at a 4% discount to the share price immediately prior to the announcement, or £8 per share. The tender into Canada was also successful, and as a result of that, Auriel was able to invest the full $68 million allocated to CIOC, resulting in its fully diluted ownership of the company increasing from 16% to 35%. We are very pleased with the success of this process. We are, however, also firmly of the view that this was a one-off event for Auriel. And as stated by the chairman in his remarks earlier today, we don't anticipate raising additional equity in the foreseeable future, and certainly as long as the share price is below NAV. The stability in our NAV is also partly driven by the substantial amount of cash in our balance sheet and by the fact that more than half of the companies in the portfolio are still early in their development and still marked at cost. However, this resilience in the context of a 30% decline in oil prices during the year is also the result of our strategy, as I mentioned earlier, diversifying the portfolio across geographies, maintaining balance sheets through hedging and moderate leverage, and deploying capital in a disciplined, phased way, which allows our companies to average down their cost basis through acquisitions and farm-in transactions at attractive valuations. Several of our portfolio companies did this successfully during 2015, including Rock Oil, Carrier, Liberty, and Origo. As of the year end, Origo committed a total of almost $1.6 billion to 16 portfolio companies, which equates to 120% of total capital raised. This $845 million has been invested, representing 64% of total capital raised. Current commitment level is appropriate given the flexibility built into our commitments, and because portfolio company assets are often fully or partially monetized prior to the drawing of the total committed capital. These realizations also added to the pool of capital available to Auriel for investment. In fact, as of year end, Auriel has realized $40 million through Riverstone Credit Opportunities. So when considering the total capital available, or 116% committed and 62% invested. Overall, the board is very comfortable with Auriel's current capital position. I'd like to pass over to Alfredo, who will go through the investment portfolio in a little bit more detail.
Thank you, Ken. So, as Ken mentioned, as of the end of 2015, our portfolio was comprised of 14 E&P companies, one midstream investment, one credit investment, and just over $550 million US of uninvested cash. Also, as he just mentioned, during this year, we focused primarily on three things. One is making sure that the portfolio was resilient in the current downturn. The second was supporting our companies in acting on opportunities to acquire high-quality assets from overstretched companies. And thirdly, to intervene in our fixed and variable costs at the portfolio company level through a combination of efficiency improvements, activity rationalization, and cooperation with supply chain partners. During the year, Auriel committed $857 million to eight companies, six of which are new portfolio companies, and five of those six are repeat management teams with whom Riverstone has partnered successfully with in the past. So we believe that over the last 26 months since the IPO, we've built a very well-diversified portfolio, which I like to think about as being broken down into four buckets of approximately the same size in terms of capital commitments. The first of those four buckets is Western Canada, which, as you've heard us describe many times, is a very prolific oil and gas region with extremely low cost production and currently experiencing a very fast growth due to the emerging Montney and Duvernay plays. As you know, we have a very prominent position in Western Canada with investments both in midstream and E&P, which includes CIOC, CNOR, Canera, and Meritage 3. The second bucket in the portfolio is the Eagle Ford and Permian region, located in Texas and New Mexico, and which, as many of you will know, consistently features in industry analysis as having among the lowest break-even prices in North America. The basin is also home to a relatively fragmented landscape of E&P companies, which makes it fertile ground for distress acquisitions in the current environment, as illustrated by two transactions announced last month by Carrier 2. We as Riverstone have backed a total of 14 companies in the Permian and Eagle Ford, and three of these are in Ariel's portfolio today, being Three Rivers 3, Rock Oil, and Carrier 2. So it's a region that we're intimately familiar and active with. Third, we have the Gulf of Mexico, where Riverstone's companies include Fieldwood, Castex, and ILX 3. And these are amongst the largest operators and most active drillers in the basin. Of course, this results in very significant economies of scale, as well as decades of subsurface data and expertise. And finally, approximately a quarter of our capital commitments are directed to other niche opportunities, such as credit, international E&P, and other onshore U.S. plays. In this bucket, for example, you'll find Sierra Oil and Gas, which, as you may remember, is a first mover in acquiring prime acreage in the Mexico oil and gas opening, or Liberty, which is, by most accounts, the most efficient operator in the core of the back-end play in the U.S. So with that, let me spend a few more minutes talking to you about the most significant updates in our existing companies, and I'll also spend a minute on the one new company that we added to the portfolio since the last time we had one of these conference calls at the time of the interim results. Let me start with CIOC. And you've already heard a little bit about CIOC from Ken a minute ago, but I'll remind you that CIOC not only has one of the most advantaged land positions in the Montney and Duvernay formations, but importantly in this environment, the company owns and operates, so has full control over this asset base. And just in the time that we have been investors in the company, we've seen the fruits of that dedication as well as of the quality of the management team, with drilling and completion costs dropping by more than half and the production more than tripling over that time to right now over 10,000 barrels a day of actual production. This is after drilling only 42 wells in the company's acreage, which is a tiny fraction of over 3,000 locations in the company's inventory of potential drilling locations. We continue to be extremely enthusiastic about this place in general and about CIOC's position and performance very specifically. As Ken mentioned earlier, we increased our investment in CIOC very substantially, and it is now the largest position in our portfolio at Ariel at $232 million, which represents 27% of our invested capital. As of the end of the year, we valued CIOC at 1.4 times cost, which we think is a relatively conservative mark when looking at CIOC's fundamentals and at how the public market values its closest peers, which is a company that many of you will be familiar with called Seven Generations. Although Seven Generations is more advanced in its drilling program, it owns a similar amount of acreage immediately adjacent to CIOC's sand base and is therefore the most direct reference point for the value of CIOC's position. Over the last quarter, this company, Seven Generations, saw its share price actually increase by 7% in Canadian dollar terms, or even 3% in U.S. dollar terms, which results in an enterprise valuation of just over $3 billion U.S. dollars. If you do basic math, that equates to about $7,000 per acre, which compares to a little bit over $2,000 per acre implicit in our fair market value for CIOC. This is a large difference, and of course we think it's justified because CIOC is 1 to 2 years earlier in its drilling program compared to seven generations, but there is no question that the growth curve of CIOC is very similar to that of seven generations, and that CIOC will follow a similar trajectory even if we put aside any recovery of the oil and gas price. So hopefully that gives you a sense for sort of the possibilities for CIOC and why we're so excited about it. Next, I'll touch on Rock Oil, which, as you may remember, is another E&P company led by a very successful onshore U.S. team, which has entered into a series of acreage acquisitions in the Midland Basin in the Permian. Rock's strategy is to aggregate subscale positions which can be developed to optimal maturity within a relatively short time frame. Earlier in 2015, we had marked this company up to 1.8 times cost, following rapid appreciation of acres that they had acquired at Howard County in Texas. And that was about 16,000 acres, which they managed to get a hold of at very attractive valuations. Then in the third quarter, Rock acquired an additional around 7,000 acres in the vicinity, but at more market terms. And this led to a total acreage position of about 23,000 net acres in the Howard. This new investment is valued at cost, and that resulted in the weighted average valuation for the entire investment to be moved to about 1.3 times cost. Meanwhile, in the fourth quarter, the company began executing its development program, which is focused on horizontal drilling primarily. If we move on to Fieldwood, Fieldwood accounts for about 4% of Ariel's capital, and our investment in Fieldwood represents about 4% as well of Fieldwood's total shareholder base. The company is the largest producer in the Gulf of Mexico, in the shallow Gulf of Mexico, and as anyone who's been paying attention will know, this is a region that has experienced the reduction in the share price of pretty much every publicly listed player in the area. And consistent with that, we've brought down the mark of Fieldwood to 0.8 times cost in the fourth quarter. And this compares to 1 times cost in September and 1.4 times cost at the end of 2014. So it's obvious that this reduction has been driven by the drop in value of publicly listed peers such as Energy 21, WNT Offshore, or Stone Energy, and as well as applying a lower oil price deck to the valuation of Fieldwood reserves and so on. However, as we consider Fieldwood, we should keep in mind that Fieldwood has significant differences to these other publicly listed companies, including a very substantial hedge book, which is has very interesting features in terms of strike prices and so on, higher operational efficiencies related to scale, and lastly but not least, the fact that it acquired assets at very attractive multiples from Apache and SandRidge, so below 3 times EBITDA. During the fourth quarter, we should note that declining prices led to Fieldwood's borrowing base being lowered by about $450 million to $1.3 billion, and this triggered a downgrade by Moody's of the rating of the company's loans earlier this month. Fortunately, the company was well prepared for the borrowing base reduction, and this was handled through a combination of cash in hand, previously unused debt capacity, and more efficient management of the company's decommissioning security obligations. At the end of 2015, the company had a cash balance of just under $200 million and a leverage ratio of 3.2 times, which is well below its 2016 covenant of 4.5 times. Operationally, Fieldwood continued to be very active in 2015, drilling 6 new wells, which resulted in 5 new discoveries. It had 44 recompletions, had significant decommissioning activity, including 140 wells, 60 pipelines, and 40 platforms. The company was also, importantly, awarded a new block in Mexico's offshore tender, which comprises 2 proven but undeveloped fields with proven reserves estimated at 68 million barrels of oil and 92 billion cubic feet of gas. We haven't included this new block in our fair market value of the company because the Fieldwood just acquired it very recently, so we're waiting for them to do some more technical work on it. Other exploration and production companies where marks fell below cost in the fourth quarter include Liberty 2 and Eagle 2, which similarly were impacted by lower EBITDA and debt capacity, as well as read across from publicly traded peers. Our credit investment, RCO, fell to 0.9 times cost after marking to market its 17 current positions. Since inception, RCO has made a total of 21 investments, four of which have already been fully exited, resulting in $40 million of gross realized proceeds to Ariel. We view Ariel's $125 million commitment to RCO as highly flexible, given the liquid nature of its underlying investments and the absence of external management staff or infrastructure. Since our last analyst call in July, as I mentioned earlier, we have added one new portfolio company to the portfolio, and this was ILX3, a company we added at the end of 2015, and which is a joint venture with Richwood Energy Corporation. This is the third time we partner with Richwood, and similar to the previous two times, the company is focused on finding and developing oil and gas fields in the Gulf of Mexico, specifically targeting areas where previous infrastructure is available to rapidly and economically tie in new discoveries, and where the company believes that the subsurface risk is relatively low on the basis of existing abundant well control data. Since we set up this partnership in 2010, the first one, Riverstone has participated in the drilling of 15 mostly deep water exploration wells, and of these 15, 13 have been deemed commercially successful discoveries. In terms of ILX3 specifically, they purchased 15 undrilled prospects from ILX2, and they have so far started drilling two wells with results expected later this quarter. So with that, let me pass you over to Ken for concluding remarks, and then we'll take your questions.
Thanks, Alfredo. So to conclude, it's been 2 years since we started, and Oriel has executed its strategy of investing in high-quality E&P and midstream assets using leverage prudently and hedging commodity price exposure. This has resulted, we believe, in a portfolio that is proving quite resilient during a highly turbulent time in the industry. Looking into 2016, there's likely to be more pain ahead for the energy industry as hedges roll off, companies face limits on their ability to trim costs, and we go through additional rounds of reserve-based redeterminations. However, this also creates significant opportunity for those who are disciplined, have the right experience, and take a long-term view. One recent example of how we are taking advantage of these opportunities is Carrier 2's acquisitions in the Eagle Ford announced last month. For the past 2 years, the company's management team and our colleagues at Riverstone have been evaluating interest in the Sugarloaf project, which is an extremely proven and large-scale development, neighboring acreage previously owned by another Riverstone portfolio company. We knew of two small listed companies owning minority positions in the project, but had been unwilling to transact at the seller's price expectations. Finally, around the end of the year, with capital markets effectively closed to small-cap E&P companies, these two companies found themselves out of options and therefore attracted to Carrier's ability to transact rapidly, albeit at approximately one-third of the average for historical transactions in the Eagle Ford. We expect to see more opportunities such as this emerging over the course of 2016. And with a strong position of over $500 million in cash and 16 portfolio companies, we are uniquely placed to capitalize on the most attractive opportunities emerging from this environment. So with that, we'd like to open the floor to any questions you may have.
So, ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you do wish to ask a question, please press star and one on your telephone keypad now and wait for your name to be announced. That's star and one to ask a question. And your first question comes from Anish Kapadia. Your line is now open.
Hi, good afternoon. A few questions from me, please. First of all, I always want to ask about hedging. Could you give some idea of the amount of hedging that you have on average across the portfolio? And I know it's difficult to probably quantify exactly, but maybe some idea of a rough percentage of production hedged this year and next year and some kind of average price if possible. Second question is just how you see returns really and the relative risk reward. Kind of interesting that you're investing in the Gulf of Mexico and some stuff internationally versus as well as US onshore. We've had a lot of commentary about companies preferring to invest onshore versus longer life portfolios. Just wondering how you think about that in the current market. And then the final one is looking at acquisitions. I was wondering if you could give some sense of what oil price deck you're using now to evaluate acquisitions. Are you using the forward curve, something above that? And maybe kind of give some sense of that with what kind of oil price was baked into the carrier acquisitions in the Eagle Ford. Thank you.
I'm happy to take that, Anish, and I'll give some comments on all three questions in order, and let's see if Ken has anything to add at the end. But in terms of hedging, as you know, as a principle, we like to hedge as much of near term, being 2 to 3 years of production, as prudent as a function of the visibility that we have to that production being relatively low uncertainty, and that we do that across all portfolio companies, and it's one of the things that we essentially treat as non-negotiable when we're negotiating the governance relations of a company. We always need control to make sure we can put our hedging strategy in practice. So in terms of specific indications, in 2016, our companies are pretty well hedged. To give you a sense, Fieldwood is about two-thirds hedged on the gas side and about 50% hedged on the oil side. Castex is more than two-thirds hedged, and I'm talking about as a percentage of the in-year production forecast. Rock is about 80%. Eagle and Liberty are well over two-thirds hedged. So in general, you'll never see us at 100%, obviously, but significantly above 50% for the next 12 months. In 2017, it becomes a little bit more heterogeneous across the portfolio because depending on, as I said, the visibility of production and specific the sort of rolling hedges programs in the different companies, the portfolios are a little bit more varied. It's certainly less than what I just described, but it's growing to those positions of, call it, two-thirds type hedging. The strike prices, as you would expect, vary widely as you would expect based on kind of different instruments and different times when the hedges are put on. But pretty much every single one of the hedges here are substantially in the money. I think Fieldwood, for example, has the current mark-to-market of the hedge book is in the order of a couple $100 million of value. So that gives you a bit of a sense, hopefully. Now, in terms of returns and onshore versus offshore, I think the biggest thing you need to remember is that unlike a big oil and gas corporation, which has a kind of multi-year stated strategy and needs to live by sort of that strategy driven by the head office, one of our biggest assets is our attribute to be very opportunistic. And at times, we have the ability to, and we want to be, a little contrarian in terms of areas where everybody is moving out, meaning that the opportunities have become available at extremely low valuations. We will again, very selectively, but we will jump on those opportunities. We, as I like to say, we live in the world of the micro, not the macro. And in line with that, we do find very specifically attractive opportunities to do things in places like the offshore Gulf of Mexico or even Norway, et cetera, et cetera. Having said that, I don't want to overstate the point. As you said, the onshore opportunities tend to be lower cost, so the vast majority of what we have done recently has been onshore. Returns and oil price X, obviously, it's a complicated question because every analysis of an acquisition involves as much discussion about risks as it does about returns. And as you know, we look at a number of different oil price X in our evaluations, and we certainly, in the current environment, are wanting to make sure that if we don't see any recovery at all, so we stay at today's historically low levels, we have a sort of sustainable, decent investment in our hands. But of course, we also look at a range of different prices, obviously including the forward strip, which is kind of everybody's reference point. But of course, you wouldn't think that our assessment is simply going to be a sort of DCF of the current strip. So it's a complicated equation, as you would expect. Ken, I'm not sure if you want to add anything to that.
No, I think Alfredo, you covered it pretty well.
Okay.
Great. Thanks very much.
And your next question comes from David Appleton. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have two questions, if I may. Number one, I just wanted to ask about whether what protections you have in place in terms of potential conflicts with your new listed vehicle in America that's just come to market. I'm just interested as to whether there's any risk of you both competing for the same opportunities or whether you'd be less investing alongside the Silver Run Acquisition Corp vehicle. My second question really is just kicking the tires a little bit more on Fieldwood. I know it's not the most material investment in the portfolio, but it is, however, the one that looks most at risk in terms of its leverage, et cetera. I'm just interested, when you read some of the commentary from the rating agencies, they're talking about unsustainable capital structure and restructuring of debt. The prices, the marks on the bonds are, you know, materially below par. I'm just interested as to whether you see some form of restructuring coming there and whether you may well be called for the balance of your equity, possibly to help with the refinancing. Thank you.
So thanks, David. Let me deal with both of those. Firstly, with respect to Silver Run, I would say two things. One, we raised $500 million in Silver Run. All of that capital has to be spent on one acquisition. And typically, if you look at blank check companies of that type, you will see that that acquisition tends to be a multiple of the capital raised. So we would expect to be targeting acquisitions, you know, well north of $500 million from a size perspective, even approaching $1 billion. And then when you look at REL, we are, you know, 120% committed. And the portfolio companies where we have committed capital but still to be invested are focused on a different strategy. They're almost to a person or to a company, I should say, focused on build-up. So there's a pretty wide fairway between the two, and I think it's inconceivable to have those compete with each other. As to whether or not down the road, REL may be able to invest alongside Silver Run in something it does, I think that's too early to say. It's going to be a question of the timing of that and REL's capital availability at that time. But we essentially see no conflicts there. And with respect to Fieldwood, look, that's something I'm not sure I can really comment on at this stage. We have we have committed but uninvested capital to Fieldwood within REL and as we have across our other funds. As to how that capital gets used, I think it's too early to say.
Okay, thank you very much.
And your next question comes from David Hasty. Please ask your question.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen. Just a question on the opportunity set and your current level of commitment. I think you mentioned you're 120% committed and that you can obviously be overcommitted because realizations come back down the line. But could you give us some form of guidance as to how constraining this number is in terms of taking up opportunities you might see this year or going forward? I mean, is there a percentage that you couldn't comfortably go above, or how do you consider this matter?
Hi, David. Thank you. So I think two things. One, at 120% committed, we're probably not going to go much above that number, I would say, sitting here today. So that's a starting point. Secondly, though, and most important, I think it's important to remember that we have almost $500 million of uninvested capital.
Right.
So when we look at the opportunity set, it's less looking for new, what I'll describe as platform portfolio companies. We're really now deep into finding opportunities and executing on opportunities within the portfolio companies themselves. So if you take a Three Rivers Three as an example, we have 100 net to Oriel. Remember, we have $156 million of uninvested capital. Rock Oil, over $50 million of uninvested. Sierra, $72 million of uninvested. Origo, almost $60 million of uninvested. So that's where, or ILX3, as Alfredo said, we have $170 million of uninvested. So I think that's where we're going to be taking advantage of the opportunity set as they present themselves.
So it's within that amount rather than additive to it. Okay.
I think, that's a good place to start. Things obviously can ebb and flow, but that's what you should assume.
Okay, thank you very much.
So as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you do wish to ask a question, please press star and one on your telephone keypad now and wait for your name to be announced. That's star and one to ask a question. So as a final reminder, that's star and one if you do wish to ask a question. And your question comes from James Thompson. Your line is now open.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon, gents. It's James from JPMorgan. Ken, previously you said to us that this has been an environment where patience has really paid. When you think about that $500 million of uninvested capital, what's your message to the management teams in your portfolio companies? I mean, is this now the point in time when you really put the foot to the floor, or do you think that, we're still a little bit ahead of the time of kind of peak distress, if you like, and clearly there's lots of eyes on the bank lending environment, et cetera. So I'd be interested to know just what the message is to those management teams today.
Well, thanks, James. I'm not sure we're messaging to them. I think they're probably messaging to us, given what they're seeing every day out in the field, so to speak. But I think we're seeing a lot more opportunity than we saw 6-9 months ago. More of it seems to be transactable. Our strategy is to focus on smaller rather than larger opportunities. And I think, CEOs that have uninvested capital, such as Mike Wistrich at ILX3, are being very opportunistic, but also being disciplined, and still being somewhat patient. But the environment's getting better and better and better for us.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
And there are no further questions at this time.
Thanks, everyone, very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's call. Thank you very much for participating. You may now disconnect. Speakers, please stay on the line.